This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. Dia Hadid is a correspondent for the New York Times. And earlier this month, she opened a series of articles with this. It is incumbent upon every able-bodied Muslim who can afford to do so to travel to Mecca, Saudi Arabia, Islam's holiest site, at least once in his or her lifetime. Hadid goes on to write, "This year, 1437, according to the Islamic calendar, I am making my first Hajj." Hadid shares the story of her experience as a pilgrim among millions and as a woman who is newly embracing the faith she left behind in college, even as she struggles with conflicting feelings about how this same faith deals with gender. Dia Hadid joins us via Skype. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi there, Mary. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. And before we get started, I'll give the number out for anyone who'd like to participate in the conversation. The number is 888-477-9499, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So Dia, let's begin with an introduction for those of us who aren't familiar with the Hajj. It's a pilgrimage that, as you said, every observant follower of Islam is asked to make at least once. Tell us about it.
Right. So the Hajj is a pilgrimage that's made to the holy sites in Mecca, which is the holiest place for Muslims. And it's a series of rites that take place over 5 or 6 days. And what those rites do is to honor the birth story of Islam that for Muslims begins with the prophet Abraham. And Muslims believe that he was sent to this barren plain across the Arabian Sea and was ordered to leave his second wife, the Egyptian Hagar, the biblical Hagar, with her son Ismail. And so what Muslims believe happened after that, and this sort of veers off the traditional biblical Christian Judaic story, is that Muslims believe that Hagar ran between the hills in this barren plain, looking for water because she feared that they would die abandoned in this area, and that they found, and she finds water, so they settle in this area. There's water. Several years later, the prophet Abraham comes back and he builds a house for God, for the worship of God, and Muslims see this as their birth story in the sense of this is where one of the first places of monotheism emerges, one of the first places of the worship of a one God. And so every year Muslims go and they circle that structure that they believe Abraham originally built. It's called the Kaaba. It's a cube. It's covered in black cloth. It has nothing inside it. It's the direction that Muslims pray to 5 times a day. Hmm. They circle it in honor of Abraham. They walk between these two hills. It is basically now an air-conditioned corridor, and we can get to why that is later.
Yeah.
And they honor how Hagar searched for water for her son, Ismail, the biblical Ishmael. They walk to a plain where they pray, and they believe that God will specifically hear and answer their prayers on this plain and on that day. They sacrifice an animal, normally a sheep, to honor how Abraham was asked by God to sacrifice his own son and at the last minute was replaced by a ram, similar to the biblical story. Mm. So you have all these different little pieces of ritual, and every little ritual honors another part of what Muslims believe is sort of the founding story of monotheism in the Arabian Peninsula.
So Dia Hadid, let's get back to the Kaaba for a moment. At its heart, it's empty.
Yeah.
Why?
It's empty, and you know, this is something that I was trying to work out myself. And as far as I understood, and I'm not a scholar, I'm a seeker and a journalist, and I'm human. Because God cannot be represented, the Muslims, like Jews, don't believe that there's any way that you can represent God. He or she is above any form of representation, and so there's nothing that you can hold in the center. It has to stay empty. And so it forces reflection inside oneself and to the community around them, because you realize that what you pray to, what you look at, is just a structure. It sort of foils itself. You're not meant to be awed by how great or amazing it is. You're meant to be awed by its very simplicity. Mm-hmm. And its lack of it, the absence of what it should hold, which forces you to seek. Yeah. what people believe is in there and is all around them, which is God.
Dia, before we get into what you saw and heard during your experience, let's talk a little bit about your background. You write that at age 38, you have a tangled history with Islam. Did you grow up in an observant household?
Yes, I did. I did. I'm half Lebanese, half Egyptian, Australian. Like a lot of Australians, I have an immigrant background. I was raised by fairly observant Muslim parents, and I come from an observant family. I myself was fairly observant until I got to university, which Americans call college. And then I sort of began a process of letting go of any sort of visible attachment to Islam. I used to wear the hijab, the headscarf. I took it off.
Why is that? What was going on in your heart and your mind at the time?
Well, I think, you know, many Muslims are sort of smart when I say this, and it's their right, but I didn't really feel that I had a place as an equal. I didn't feel that I was being seen as a fully formed human, not only just as a spiritual person, but as a physical person in the world. And because Muslims believe that men and women are spiritually equal, there's no favor put upon men to, you know, to be liked by God more or something like that. They're equal spiritually. But in the world, certain things offended me, and they don't have to offend anyone, but they offended me. I didn't like standing at the back of a room to pray. I didn't like the idea that my voice was somehow considered of something that I should disguise or conceal or speak in a low voice because it might be attractive. I didn't like the fact that in some judicial matters, my ability to witness was half of that of a man's. That seemed to me to be a structural inequality that had to be talked about and dealt with. And while I was struggling with that, I didn't want to visibly represent Islam. I wanted to ask myself those questions and sort them out for myself before I went around claiming to be a Muslim or representing myself as a Muslim to other people.
So, Dia, what brought you back to your faith fully or more fully?
Well, I wouldn't even say that I've circled back. I think it's just that the Hajj opened another side of the faith to me. I mean, I should be clear, I don't think there's any one true faith in the world. I think humans are too plural, and we have such that I think often the answer is in our diversity. So I wouldn't claim to be any more devout today than I was before I went to the Hajj, mm-hmm. or that Islam is the only right religion that feels beyond who we are as people. But I went to the Hajj because I wanted to see what the Hajj was about. I wanted to see if it would recenter me somehow, if it would help answer some of the questions I've always had about faith and the creator and the universe. And I feel like somehow my soul expanded at the Hajj. I found more peace. But I wouldn't say that in any way I returned being visibly more Muslim or any more observant, possibly to the great disappointment of of people who were hoping that would happen.
Well, let's get into the experience. Even
sure.
Before you went, you wrote that the Hajj requires both physical and spiritual preparation. And spiritually, you had to seek forgiveness of those whom you'd wronged, and you needed to forgive those who'd wronged you, not always an easy thing. And this included the dentist who damaged your teeth and still asked for $1,000.
Yes, yes. I'd like to say forgiveness is hard.
Many of us know that, Dia.
You know, suddenly you're presented with this idea that you have to close the book of your life. And, you know, in so many ways it was frustrating because, you know, you have legitimate grievances. You know, someone wronged me. I would like some sort of justice for that. And then there's my father's voice on the other side of the line saying, close it and let it go. And then
He's in Australia at the time?
He's in Australia. Yes, he lives in Australia. And there was something very liberating about that, though. Like, yeah, I lost thousands of dollars. I'm going to lose thousands of dollars more. And this is ridiculous and unfair and expensive. But it's nice to let things go.
So physical preparation, good shoes, extremely important. You'd initially planned to wear hiking boots, but then your mother steps in. Tell us about that.
I was such a Hajj rookie.
Well, you would think, how many miles are you covering?
You know, I wish I'd bought a Fitbit.
just to see physically how much I was walking. But I mean, I think I did a solid 3 to 5 kilometers whenever I was in Mecca, walking around the Kaaba, as Muslims do, circulate the Kaaba 7 times. There was a lot of walking involved. It was pretty physically grueling. So I had one idea of what one wears on the Hajj, and then my sister and my mother intervened and said, no, comfortable shoes have to be easy to slip on and off. You can't get them caught up, because if you trip in any way at the Hajj, you can be crushed just because of the sea of humanity that moves around you. They were quite worried about sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. And my family had done Hajj over several different years. And I realized now that every time they had gone, they had experienced a different pilgrimage from the others. They were really concerned about sexual harassment. They didn't want me to wear shoes in which I'd have to like bend over. They wanted me to wear a zip-up robe so that it couldn't be pulled open by accident or by design. As it happens, in the end, I didn't experience any sexual harassment of any kind, which I'm happy and grateful for. And I thought, well, maybe in that sense, the pilgrimage has changed. There's far more security, I suspect, on the ground now.
Yeah, that was my next question. Does the Saudi government offer any protection, police patrolling?
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. I'd spoken to security officials that said they'd put in about 100,000 security officials to oversee the Hajj. That was everything from officers who sat in control rooms to the men who were directing traffic on the street. They were everywhere. It was a very palpable presence. I mean, of course, for the Saudis, they're concerned for a few things. They want to avoid pileups and crushes like what happened last year, where over 2,300 people were killed in a crush. Right. And they also want to avoid militant attacks, because even though it is the holiest site of Islam, groups like the so-called Islamic State might still see it as a legitimate target. Because they're also locked in a regional rivalry with Iran, they wanted to prevent any incidences of violence that would come in the backdrop of their now like years long running proxy wars that they're playing out in the region between them in Syria and in Yemen.
Well, briefly before we get to the break, let's just touch on the story between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Iran blames Saudi Arabia for the deaths of over 400 Iranian pilgrims at last year's Hajj. And Iranians were not visible at this year's, correct? I don't know that they were actually allowed by their country to attend.
It was completely unclear why Iranians weren't there. When I was pressing Saudi officials on it, they were saying that the Iranian government had not come to an agreement with the Saudis to allow their pilgrims in. Every country has to make a unilateral agreement with the Saudis on how many pilgrims I'll send and under what conditions. But they wouldn't explain what details had snagged that deal, and it seemed to have come in the context of their long-running proxy wars now.
Dia, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're up against a break, but we'll talk more after the break. Dia Hadid is a correspondent for the New York Times. She chronicled her first Hajj pilgrimage for the paper, and if you'd like to jump into the conversation, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and our guest this hour is Dia Hadid, a correspondent for the New York Times. She wrote about her first Hajj for the paper, and we're talking about her experience for the first portion of the show today. Again, our number is 888-477-9499. And Dia, you spoke before the break of some of the dangers, frankly. The mass of humanity is so enormous at the Hajj, an estimated, 2 million people this year? And there's a very real danger of being trampled. You write of your brother who did the Hajj when he was 31, and he wrote on the family app, "You will often be stuck in human traffic moving only by the will of people around you, almost like a wave carrying you." What was that like?
I'm claustrophobic.
It's not a good start. I think most of us would be claustrophobic in that situation, no?
I mean, there was two things. And again, this is why I'd say that my Hajj was quite different from my siblings and my parents who'd all gone in different years, is that it was much less crowded this time. And I wonder if that's because the you know, tens of thousands of Iranian pilgrims were not there. But there was a lot more order this time. And so the Saudi police were closing off areas when they reached a certain amount of people who had already entered them and were diverting people elsewhere. So the crowds weren't as bad as what my family had described to me. That said, when I was walking around the Kaaba, when I decided to get up right up close to the cube structure itself, it was crowded. I mean, you really do sway and move with people. And I, because I tend to get quite nervous in crowds, I just had to take a deep breath and really just, sounds like a cliche, but just like throw it up to God. Like, I just going to have to put my trust that this is going to go well, because I can't panic. I don't want to think about it more than I have to. And I'm just going to trust that everybody I'm leaning on is also leaning on me. And that's what happens. And then you're just moving, yes, in these human waves.
And during this time of the year, it's hot. It's hot. What were the temperatures like?
So I had to, I'm Australian, so we work in Celsius, and I had to convert it to Fahrenheit for the office. Often around 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It was quite hot. And so what the pilgrims did for each other is that the Saudis distribute a lot of free water at the Hajj, and then you have what Muslims believe is holy water, the water of Zamzam, that they believe that Hagar, the wife of Abraham, originally found. And so there's taps everywhere, and people fling water on each other. And it was a fairly sort of joyous thing at the Hajj that, you know, amid this like very serious rituals that you're doing, and it's hot and you're sweating, suddenly it's like, vzz, out of nowhere, someone's thrown water at you, and they're laughing and they're waiting for you to throw water back. So yes, that's how a lot of people were keeping cool. And even there were pilgrim volunteers who were just walking around spraying water on people's faces. They just wanted to do some acts of charity while they were on pilgrimage. And then there was also volunteer Saudi policemen who were spraying people as they walked. It was literally their job. They had sort of spray cans, and they were just dousing people with water as they walked around.
Let's talk about clothing. In one of your articles, you write of sitting near a group of four Saudi women dressed in identical billowing black robes and black gloves, their faces covered with not one but two veils. And one of them asks you, "Sister, where are your socks? Don't you know you have to cover your feet?" And well, and then you go on to say, "There it was again. I was at once frustrated by Islam's nitpicky strictures on women's dress and embraced by its warm sisterhood." My first thought in reading this was how, you know, despite the availability of water and pilgrims trying to help each other, that must be just a recipe for heat stroke for some people dressed in black and robes and gloves and veils.
It should be, but you don't see many people suffering from it. People drink a lot of water. They stay cool. They sit in the shade and air-conditioned places. So I realize that when you look at it from the outside, the first thing you think is, boy, it must be hot in there. Most women seem to be, who were veiled, seem to be perfectly fine with it. These women were dressed far more conservatively than even the conservative tone of dress that one wears around the holy sites. But they were working in the holy sites, sort of not quite religious police, but sort of keeping order in the women's areas. But they were a warm sisterhood, and that's the thing that I had to keep, that kept touching me at the same time as that frustration. These are women who popped out a thermos of coffee, I don't know from where. They had dates. We were snacking in the mosque waiting for prayers to start. They showed me their little prayer counters, which I thought were Fitbits.
What did they look like?
It turns out that women who knit and embroider also keep them, because they mark lines. They're just like little rings that you put on your finger, and you has two buttons. I think one is just to reset, and the other one, every time you press it, a number pops up, like 001, 002, 003. And I think that the woman who offered me her Fitbit for the soul, as my editor began calling it, had reached 200. I think it was like 286. Prayers. I politely declined to offer And I did not mean to be rude. It's really quite rude in Arab culture to decline a gift that's given to you. But I was more worried that I would break it. Yeah. And also, I'm a pedantic, old-fashioned woman. I keep prayer beads to count my prayers.
Whatever works, right?
Truly, whatever works.
So, Dia Hadid, on the third day of the Hajj, pilgrims throw rocks at three stone pillars. Tell us about this.
Right. It sounds so weird, right? It's again, so every time I talk about a rite of the Hajj, what it nearly always goes back to is one of these birth stories of Islam. And this one involves when Abraham was walking with his son Ismail to a plain to slaughter him on God's command. The devil came and tempted him and tried to convince him not to slaughter his son. And Abraham threw stones at this devil who was trying to tempt him away from the commands of God. And so Muslims honor this through these three enormous pillars that represent the devil. And over 3 days, they will stone those pillars. And you have to have a pretty steady hand because there's a lot of crowds. And so if you're not throwing them properly, you'll end up hitting people. Mm. The first time I did it personally, it really was like, this is, I mean, it's weird.
Well, perhaps it takes a little bit getting used to the new custom.
You know, and then, but it was also interesting. And then what happened as I was throwing those stones at that enormous pillar, along with thousands of people around me, is that I began thinking about my own devils. And by that, I just mean like my own massive flaws as a human, and how much in that moment I was just stoning that. And I thought it was probably the same for many of the pilgrims around me, that when you're standing there and you're stoning what is the symbolic devil, what you're really stoning and what you're really acknowledging perhaps is your own battle with your own demons.
So even as this is new and you're trying to get your arms wrapped around it, You're taking something away that's really, it just seems unique and deep and special.
It was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. I was surprised that when I tried to pick apart the pilgrimage, it did. It looked odd and weird to me. And I'd really just sort of come to accept that, well, it is what it is and I'm just going to do it. But then when I walked away from it, and this is really the inexplicable, which is, I think, the wonderful thing generally about spirituality or faith, is that I walked away from it, a different person than I had begun it, with probably, I don't want to say I had any great spiritual insight, but I felt like something had transformed in the act of doing those things, which I think is a pretty uniform story for any pilgrimage. It's not unique to Islam. It just so happens that that was the pilgrimage that I had the honor of doing.
Let's talk some more about some of the religious rituals associated with the Hajj, one of which you mentioned earlier is the slaughtering of an animal to share with the poor. As a modern Muslim, you're not expected to do this yourself. How does this work?
So this one delighted me. You pay at the post office.
I'm trying to get the connection. Explain.
Well, you know, I mean, the post office is a place to pay bills, and it's the same role that it has in Saudi Arabia. And so for the animal sacrifice, it's normally a goat, a sheep, a cow, or a camel. Mostly it's sheep. The way that it works is that you pay, the government sets a price every year for how much that sheep costs. So there's no bargaining. There's no one who's going to overcharge you or anything like that. You pay the set price. It's about $100. You go to the post office, you pay, they will give you a receipt with a barcode. So if you want to double check that that sacrifice has happened, you can go to the slaughterhouse and they'll scan the barcode and tell you whether your specific animal has been killed. Or you can get a message, a text message. But if you do it right before the slaughter is meant to happen, in the day or two before the slaughter is meant to happen, they won't send you a text message because the system is always down, because doesn't technology always just fail us when we need it the most?
It seems to.
it's a Saudi bank called the Islamic Bank, which oversees these enormous industrial slaughterhouses where the slaughter happens. And I can't confirm because I wasn't physically able to go to those slaughterhouses, but they say that they slaughter the animals, freeze them pretty quickly, and then ship them abroad to aid groups that work in Muslim communities abroad to distribute meat to them. I got to go to a local slaughterhouse where Saudi residents go to slaughter their own animals. And it was a, I eat meat. So I like the process of also watching how animals are turned into meat. I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that an animal does die for us to eat.
You're not removed from it.
No, that you're not removed from it. That meat doesn't come just in a styrofoam packet. An animal does die for that. And so I went to the slaughterhouse, and it was so funny because, you know, the Saudi post office is cool and it's air conditioned and there's your barcode and everything is very official and clean and tidy. And a slaughterhouse is a hot, sweaty, humid mess, and there's blood and entrails and leftover hoofs, and there's beggars outside and there's beggars inside, and the butchers are wearing red shirts, which I found hilarious. They all look like pirates.
So you were able to find some sense of humor in this place, which was, you know, to describe it sounds a little disturbing, even for those of us who are not vegetarians.
I think, well, I mean, to switch a little philosophical, I think philosophically, I think meat is disturbing. We kill things to eat them. I'm probably a bit less sensitized to it because I was raised in a family where we would go and slaughter our own animals because there was no halal meat where I was growing up. And so I'm used to seeing animals being slaughtered and dismembered and put into bags. So I know what meat looks like. I know what meat looks like before it's meat. But that also means I don't eat it very often.
Dia Hadid, you went both as pilgrim and journalist. And if a person is covering the Hajj professionally, the Saudi government assigns a minder. What is this person's role?
This person's role is so many things. Let's talk about the negative aspects of a minder first. A minder means that you are not free to do your own interviews independently, or you're not meant to. In reality, I did my interviews freely and independently because my minder didn't think he had to come with me everywhere. I suspected the real role of a minder would have been if there was a massive accident like there was in 2015.
Yeah.
I asked myself if the minder would then ensure that I did not see what I was meant to see as a journalist. But that didn't happen. There were no accidents this year, so I didn't, thank God, have to test out that theory. It meant that if I was taking photos, a minder would be walking with me everywhere with all the papers showing that I was legally allowed to take photos in that area. And so a lot of their job was really just dealing with security officials on my behalf. The Hajj is an enormous security problem. It's a logistical problem.
Yeah.
Journalists aren't always welcome. And so one of the positive aspects of having a minder was that I could just do my job while he dealt with security and people wanting to know why this woman was taking photos in a holy site.
All right.
And well, in that way, it was immensely useful to me.
We only have a few minutes before we have to let you go. So let's get in a comment from Chip. He emails us and says, many years ago, I learned that Malcolm X had a transformative experience while on Hajj. Your explanation of having to forgive others gives context to Malcolm's post-Hajj expanded views about America's racial problems. Now, I know you did some reading for your spiritual preparation, and Malcolm X was among your reading choices?
That's right. Because I think he had the most profound Hajj experience I'd ever read. And it changed him so profoundly that I thought, if I want to read something about how the Hajj can move people, I want to read Malcolm X. And I mean, if I recall correctly from the book, I think what moved him was just the sheer mix of humanity that exists in the Hajj. The world is very black and it's very brown when you're on the Hajj. It's also Chinese and Indonesian and Pakistani. And you feel not so much that everybody is equal, because even on the Hajj, in which people are meant to be equal, they're not. There are differences between the rich and the poor, and they're immediate and obvious. But you have a greater sense that you're just one tiny person among tens of thousands of people, and all these people have this incredible variety of height and weight and build and color. And there's just something very incredible about seeing and experiencing that. That for 6 days, you're going to suspend the inequality that exists around you, and you're going to do your best to be equal for something that's much greater than you. It really is. That part really is profound. And I think I walked away understanding more what Malcolm X had meant when he was there.
So we have not quite 2 minutes left. As you write, the greatest day of the Hajj is that in which you visit Mount Arafat. Why is that? Take us there.
Okay, so it's called the Day of Arafat, and it's where Muslims believe that if you make a prayer on that day in that plain, it's a plain with a small little hill in the middle that looks a bit like an outsy belly button, and it's called the Mount of Mercy. Muslims believe that if you make a prayer on that day in that plain, that it is answered. And so there's something very beautiful about it. Everybody, as a Muslim, everybody will write to you and say, can you please pray for XYZ? I had a prayer that my friend's mother's cancer wouldn't come back and that her divorced daughter would get married again. And my mother asked me to pray that I would have a husband.
Oh, yeah, she did.
I did it at the
and
last
did you?
I'd say that one hasn't quite been answered yet. But one of the things that I found the most amazing about when you go, when someone presents you with, honestly, I don't even care if it's true or not. Does God really answer prayers? Like, that's a pretty pedantic thing to do. We ask for very specific things. But one of the things that you realize is that as you ask for things is how much that you have. And so you end up just being, more than anything, incredibly grateful for everything. It's one of the counterintuitive moments of when someone asks you to pray for something, is that as you reel through the Rolodex of your needs and desires, you realize that mostly you have what you need.
Dia Hadid, we only have about 10 seconds. Many Muslims make the pilgrimage more than once. Do you see yourself doing so?
I hope so. I'd love to go back. Thank you so much, Mary. I appreciate this interview.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Cheers.
Dia Hadid is correspondent for the New York Times, and she tells us of her first Hajj pilgrimage. After the break, we'll talk about the Philly Free Streets Festival. City official Matt Fisher will be here. Join us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been about a year now since Pope Francis visited Philadelphia. I covered the event for WHYY, and one thing I remember about heading back from the giant outdoor mass at Eakins Oval were the streets. They were utterly devoid of traffic. Roads had been closed to cars and trucks for security reasons, and now they were filled with people from all walks of life, pushing strollers, walking to trains and restaurants, riding bikes. It felt kind of like a big party. So tomorrow, the city is going to try a smaller version of the traffic box. Remember that? Only it sounds much nicer. It's the Philly Free Streets Festival, and it kicks off tomorrow morning. And here to tell us all about it is Matt Fisher, Director of Policy in the Office of Transportation and Infrastructure Systems for the City of Philadelphia. Hi, Matt.
Hi. You can just call Otis instead of the long
Otis.
Office of Transportation and Infrastructure Systems.
I will try to remember that. So how did we get from the traffic box, which as you recall a year ago, many commuters were just dreading, to a street festival?
So, we don't want to call it a street festival necessarily.
Okay.
Either. You know, we really, because that implies, you know, it's more about businesses and vendors and a beer garden or something like that. And this event's really about active transportation. And, you know, there's a lot of impacts, positive impacts, that active transportation can bring, especially in a city with high rates of diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, the highest among any of the top 10 big cities. So we look at it as more of a festival, and really, you know, this is an event. This is, you know, one that we want to repeat. I don't know how many times yet. You know, let's just get this one done.
Yeah. There is a real focus on fitness.
Yes, there is a real focus on fitness. And, you know, my office, we do a lot of the Indigo, you know, active management of that program.
Yeah, the bike sharing program.
Yeah, the bike share program. And that's, you know, one thing that we're really trying to encourage, use of Indigo, use of biking, use of walking, use of public transit. Even for our volunteers, a lot of events, you know, they offer parking. You know, here's a lot for volunteers. We're not doing that. We're serious about and committed to promoting active transportation, the sustainability, you know, health benefits.
Sure. So let's I'd like to, before we get into the details, just mm-hmm. kind of trace the story a little bit. You know, there was this experience of many streets in Center City being closed down during the visit for security reasons at the time
last
year.
And people loved it.
Yeah, people loved it. Some all right, not everybody. We can get into that too. But there was a group, I think it's called Open Streets PHL, which mm-hmm. launched a petition campaign because some people really enjoyed the experience. Can you take it from there for us?
Yeah. You know, Open Streets PHL did a really great job of sort of capturing the sentiment of all the people who are out there enjoying the party of the open streets. And we've worked with them to sort of get their input at least. You know, they're passionate. They're smart. You know, they've been a great, you know, teammate to work with in this journey. That said, you know, it's really it is a city initiative at this point.
Sure.
And we brought Open Streets PHL is still involved. They'll still be there on Saturday with volunteer shirts on and helping along. But they were really great advocates for this, you know.
Well, I was curious about you had this traffic box, which again mainly covered Center City, and now tell us about where Philly Free Streets is going to be. You have these roads closed off from point A to point B, and what is that? It's not the traffic box route; it's something else.
It is not the traffic box route. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about the route and where we wanted to go, and there was a survey done. You know, at the end of the Nutter administration, you know, to just see where people wanted this a first event to happen. You know, this was being talked about right after the Pope. You know, it wasn't 6 months later. It was right after the Pope. So we spent a lot of time thinking about that and what was a good corridor, a good commercial corridor that would be able to, you know, be accepting of this as a first time out. You know, some businesses are skeptical about being able to receive deliveries, you know, dry cleaners, for example, you know, they feel like they might be impacted.
Yeah.
But we wanted to go with a commercial corridor that's used to sort of some of type of similar events.
So what does the corridor look like?
So the corridor starts at Front and South,
mm-hmm.
And it goes river to river. All the way to the Schuylkill River Trail, the South Street Bridge connecting to the Schuylkill River Trail. And we really wanted to connect to the parks also. You know, we talk about, in the open streets movement, the streets are, you know, we're reclaiming the streets as public space. And I think part of that is integrating them in with the park. Our office does we have a ped bike plan. We, you know, a network of trails that are all supposed to work with the bike lanes and to be integrated into one thing. So we thought that was an important piece. And in this, you know, similarly, you know, the park has been since 1994 had a type of an open street event on Dr. Martin Luther King Drive
mm-hmm.
every weekend, you know, for, you know, seasonally. And we wanted to celebrate that. That's been going on since 1994. And, you know, we think that it's important to recognize, you know, that we were thinking about this back then, that we recognize the benefits of the, you know, active transportation and you know, the fun of having not cars around.
So if a family or anybody wanted to go from one end to the other of Philly Free Streets, could they walk that then or ride it? And how long is it?
It's nearly 10 miles.
Okay.
It's because it goes, once you connect to from South Street to the Schuylkill River Trail, it is all of MLK up to Falls Bridge. But you can also go off into Sweetbriar area right next to Please Touch Museum, sort of between Please Touch Museum and the zoo. And there's going to be the city representative, office of the city representative will be, they'll have a concert there featuring local talent. There'll be some food trucks, November Project, a popular, you know, fitness group will be doing like a boot camp. There'll be,
and is this all, does this cost anything?
All free. Philly Free Streets is free. We didn't want vendors. A lot of vendors came out and wanted to be involved. We wanted it to be.
Was this to protect the restaurants who might have been a little bit apprehensive? Oh, people can't maybe drive up, but
you know, I mean, that's we certainly want to encourage the businesses, yeah. But we also want to be giving a lot of. We want things to be free. You know, one of the things that we've incorporated. We've partnered with Via Fitness. It is a local startup fitness app. And what they do is they sort of they offer challenges through the app that, you know, if you open up the app, you see a challenge, say, run 3 miles, save 15% at, you know, whatever.
Oh, fun.
Fitness store or nutrition. It's all healthy options. And so we partnered with them so that we could have challenges for people that day that wanted to, if you start at Front and South and you want to jog or walk or stroll, you know, skip.
And there will be volunteers kind of explaining this process at various
yes.
points along the route.
Yeah. So we have hundreds of volunteers along the route. We'll have 10 information stations. Hundreds of volunteers. Water will be given out throughout most of the corridor that was donated by AARP.
And it's family friendly, so no booze.
No booze, you know. To the, you know, some people wish there was that, but.
Well, it's a different flavor.
It is. It is. No, this is a different type of event. And, you know, but, and in addition to having sort of this fitness app, you know, component, we don't want to exclude anyone. We don't want to exclude anyone who can't afford a phone but wants to come out and participate or can't afford data. So there's also going to be paper passports. So you'll be able to go around, go to activities, participate in yoga or participate in a boot camp or watch a mural be painted.
And this is all while walking down the middle of the street because there's no traffic.
No traffic. There's no cars in the parking lane, and even some of a lot of the activities that we're talking about aren't going to be right smack in the middle of South Street. They will be on one of the north-south roads that intersects. So maybe, you know, half of a block, you know, north, you know, we cut off and we'll be, you know, barricaded. And there'll be maybe a dance party. And you can come in, you can Zumba, you can learn how to salsa dance. We've got a really exciting lineup. And you know, we never anticipated having a 10-mile course or route. And
it's kind of blossomed.
When we put the call out for people interested, you know, it just exploded. And we've been reviewing applications and, you know, working with people. And it's really been fun to communicate with the people and how excited they are about this.
So you're finding there's a real appetite for it in this city. Other cities have done this. New York, L.A.
L.A., San Francisco, Pittsburgh recently, the past couple of years, started doing it.
Did you look to them and what they've done to just kind of capture any thoughts about the Philly?
Absolutely. Yeah, we went and visited with New York. Staff went to Portland to see their event, participate in a conference. We made phone calls around the country. We did our due diligence for sure. And, you know, our office it's a group of transportation planners. So this is heaven for them researching this.
This is a fun assignment.
Yeah.
So what's uniquely Philly? I mean, you took some perhaps thoughts back from these other cities, but this is a uniquely Philly event.
It is, you know, and I think, you know, this is our first year out. So I think we're going to find what works and what doesn't, you know. And, you know, when I say that, I'm not announcing a second one right away. But I believe this is going to be a big success and that there will be more to come. What I think we also wanted to do, particularly in venturing off of MLK and South Street, was we wanted to reach some more communities, more diverse communities than necessarily what might be a center city crowd. Mm-hmm. And you know, we've been welcomed in the neighborhoods in Parkside and Mantua, and we've gone out to meetings, and people are excited too. So we anticipate it to be a really interesting event that's, you know, diverse and everyone have a good time.
So, Matt Fisher, what's off limits? I mean, bicycles are allowed. We're going to have people power walking, including the mayor. We'll get back to get to that just a moment. Jogging, but skateboards. I mean, is there anything that two thumbs up?
You can skateboard. Yeah. You're hard away.
All right.
Rollerblade, dance.
It's all about movement. Jump.
Yeah, it's all about moving.
All right. Allison in Orland has called in to Radio Times, so let's get to her call. Welcome to Radio Times, Allison.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I plan on biking in with my son on Saturday. And my question is, would there ever be a possibility of having a regular shutdown on something like Benjamin Parkway or a significant street in Philadelphia? I believe they do it in Paris for the Champs-Élysées, sort of first Sunday of the month or something along those lines, where we can set up a regular closure for events like this.
Thanks, Allison.
I mean, absolutely, we're exploring that. You know, like this is the first event, and we're still figuring out where we want to take this. You know, I think there's a lot of opportunities to, in addition to using something like the parkway that's, you know, big and wide and beautiful already, but going into other parts of the neighborhood where you wouldn't, other neighborhoods in the city where you wouldn't expect this event to take place, so, you know, and you can make positive change, you know, by coming in and, you know, sort of normalizing the idea of you don't need to drive everywhere. You can bike. And as we expand our Indigo system, we want this to be, you know, we want to make this behavior that everyone thinks is, you know, the normal way of being. It's not just hop in your car.
All right. So Mayor Kenney is going to be out there tomorrow morning. And if you get to, I read in the information, South and Second. I still have two stuck in the back of my mind. Is it 2 Street or 2nd Street? What are you guys saying in the city?
So South and Second.
South and Second. Okay.
Right, head house right there.
9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. The managing director will be doing a ribbon cutting at 8 a.m. at the same location. Patty Jackson, a radio personality who she had a stroke a year ago, I believe, and she's going to be leading a walk without a cane. Councilman Curtis Jones will also be leading a bike ride starting at 11 from Falls Bridge for some of his constituents. So everybody's
You'll
getting
have company
involved.
If you want to jump in. One more quick question, Matt. This is kind of a fun portion of the event. You've got a scavenger hunt. Where is that taking place, and what are people scavenging for?
So, well, we've got a variety of prizes. You know, we've got Philly Free Streets gear to give away, plus some other really interesting big prizes. So there'll be clues posted.
Whereabouts?
They'll be on street signs. They'll be all over the place. You'll be able to participate through the app. The more clues you get, the more activities you visit, you also get raffle tickets. And some of these raffle tickets can include winning potentially a free bib to the Broad Street Run.
Oh.
Yeah. Or
so something for everybody.
Fitbits.
I'm going to have to stop you there because we're out of time, but 8 until 1 tomorrow, right?
That's right.
Okay, Matt Fisher, it was a pleasure. Matt is Director of Policy for Otis, and that's with the City of Philadelphia. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page. Just head to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you will find our podcast there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening to Radio Times.